and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Associate Professor of Neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School of Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science, Dr. Lise Elliott. Dr. Elliott received her PhD in psychology and cellular biophysics from Columbia University in 1991. She joined the Chicago Medical School faculty in 1998 and currently teaches neuroscience and ethics in biomedical research. Dr. Elliott has published more than 50 works, including What's Going On in There? How the Brain Develops in the First 5 Years of Life. In addition to teaching and writing, Dr. Elliott lectures widely on children's brain and mental development. Hosted by Best Beginnings at the Wilda Marston Theater, her talk, based on her latest book, Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It, was recorded in Anchorage on February 1st.
Wow. Thank you. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be here and what a great time I've had in Alaska so far. I was here 30 years ago as a college student, got a job up at McKinley Village, you know, not knowing where that was or what that was. McKinley sounded pretty good, though. and fell in love with Alaska, and like many of you, dreamed about maybe settling down here, you know, shooting a moose and living through the winter. And then life caught up with me and other things, and I kind of forgot about this Alaska dream. But boy, being back up here, I don't know. If you guys don't open a medical school and hire my husband and me, I don't know, we might just have to retire here. So much for the Sun Belt. Anyway, thank you so much for the warm welcome, and for, you've already heard about all the sponsors, but I'm equally very appreciative of all the groups that got together, and very impressed with Bright Beginnings and the work that they've done, putting those books in the hands of so many young children every month. Must be just the best experience you can imagine for them. I hope to explain to you why that's such a good experience. Although the bulk of my talk will be addressing the issue of gender, which I know is always of interest to everybody. So let me just jump right in and kind of get to the heart of the matter. Over the last 20 years or so, we've sort of done this seesaw from kind of a wrenching worries about girls. Remember this book, Reviving Ophelia, some of you may recall, about the crisis of adolescent girls and when they hit 11 and girls lose their confidence and so on. And you know, there was a little bit of truth in that, although it was a little bit based on anecdote. But other research by the Sadkers was able to document some significant differences in the way boys and girls are treated in the classroom, and raised a lot of alarm bells for parents and teachers, noting that boys were getting called on more than girls, and girls were, you know, maybe not getting as much attention. Now, to be honest, a lot of the attention boys are getting in classrooms has to do with discipline and is not necessarily positive. So ultimately, the pendulum has swung, and in the last even less than 10 years, I would say, we now are completely consumed with the boy crisis. The girls are solved. Everything's great with girls now. And we're all up in arms about the boy crisis. There's been 3 books in recent years, War Against Boys, which is probably the most extreme, The Trouble with Boys by Peg Tyre, who's a journalist. She had a cover story in Newsweek that got a lot of press, Why Boys Fail. You get the theme here. We're worried about boys academically, and there certainly are some numbers that back that up, the most important being the high school graduation rate gap and college enrollment. So girls graduate in higher numbers than boys. That's been true actually for a very long time, but that doesn't mean it's a good thing. And then the college enrollment gap, in the good, bad old days, men of course outnumbered women in college, and then there was this crossover in the 1980s where women started to go in greater numbers, and now about 57% of college students in the U.S. are female. And that's not a good thing, given that the future of employment increasingly will need a college degree. So I do have concerns about boys. I have concerns about girls. But I honestly don't think either one is in crisis. And unfortunately, that is fueling a lot of the discussion of boys and girls. And so, you know, some people who don't want to pick boys or girls will pick both. And so any of you are familiar with Leonard Sachs's writing, he's got both bases covered. You can sell more books that way, right? Girls are on the edge. Boys are adrift. It's all a big disaster. Well, the problem is that this, unfortunately, this crisis mentality actually strays from the real data. Yes, we have concerns about boys and girls at different stages in their education, but every child's different. And just unfortunately, singling them out as boys or girls can lead to a lot of stereotyping. And so what I'm in particular concerned about is this growing notion that I think teachers are hearing that boys and girls learn differently. And so this is from the Atlantic Public Schools. I did a web search one day and found literally about 20 public schools posting right on their website statements of this sort: boys and girls learn differently. And, you know, I had started to believe that, too, when I first started, before I got into my research. But ultimately, I had to address this question: what research? What research is really telling us that boys and girls learn differently? And if you look at sort of laboratory studies of learning, of processing information, of remembering and repeating, and there really isn't good evidence that the male brain and the female brain learn differently. So boys and girls have certain differences, but unfortunately, this is being extrapolated and exaggerated in classrooms so that, for example, there's a big growth of single gender education across the lower 48 that is based on this claim. So let me tell you how I got into this. As you, I think, heard, I wrote a first book on brain development, and I'll talk a bit about that. And really is quite pertinent to the work that Best Beginnings is doing. And along the way, came across some studies about boys and girls. And so I proposed the title of this book, Pink Brain, Blue Brain, before I actually had completed my research, because it got to the point that, you know, I want to explore boys and girls and why they're different and what about their brain. But ultimately, I really probably should have put a big question mark here, because I don't actually believe that there's such a thing as a male brain and a female brain. There are group level statistical differences, but as I hope to show you, there's much more overlap and similarity between males and females at the behavioral, neural, cognitive, emotional level than there is difference. So instead of putting a question mark in my title, we just wrote the pink and blue and the blue and pink, in case you didn't notice, and tried to suggest that there might be a little ambiguity there. So I want to just give you the synopsis, because what I'm going to, the data I'm going to show to you is a little bit complex. And so I want you to kind of have the framework before we get into it. Basically, there are real differences between the sexes, but it's certainly not of the scale of this men are from Mars, women are from Venus kind of, we're different alien creatures. And certainly, to the degree that nature or there's any kind of hardwired basis for these differences, it's attributable to prenatal testosterone, and I'll show you the evidence for that. But really, the evidence is pretty darn subtle. I looked long and hard at the research of many others, and, you know, for example, one of everybody's favorite ideas is that if prenatal testosterone is important, then girls with twin brothers should be different from girls with twin sisters, right? Because when you grow up in the womb and you're exposed to a little bit of this testosterone. And frankly, the research on opposite sex twins is just all over the map and not convincing at all. And I know some of the scientists who do it have just given it up, because you're not going to learn anything about prenatal testosterone from that. So there is an effect, but I hope to show you it's pretty subtle. And if it does anything, it's just a bias. It just sort of sways the leaves a little bit. But really, most of the differences, I believe, between boys and girls are largely a matter of what we do with our brains as boys and girls that are different. And so I hope to show you the evidence for that. And so ultimately, please take away, there really is no such thing as a male brain and a female brain. I know there's a couple of very popular books out with that title. The male brain has this picture of a brain constructed out of duct tape. The female brain, of course, is made out of connective phone cables, and that sort of says it all. And it makes a nice a nice little metaphor. Lou Anne Brizendine, who wrote those books, is selling a lot more books than I am, but it really is a very far stretch, and in some ways quite harmful, I think. Imagine if we wrote books about the Hispanic brain and the Caucasian brain, and people would be pretty outraged, and it's really an extrapolation of the data to do this. Okay, so what I instead hope to do is give you a little bit more nuanced view of how nature and nurture interact to produce sex differences, and more importantly, to think about, to the extent that gender differences are socially learned and created through changes in the brain, the better we understand that, the earlier we can step in and, I think, work to the benefit of both boys and girls to close some of these academic gaps, to close some of these personal and mental health gaps that I think are not healthy in today's world, where men and women have to raise families together, have to run governments together, have to work together. So that's the take-home message. Let me try to get you there with some of the evidence. So, first, I'm going to give you a little primer on brain development, which this is my area of expertise and how I approach the whole issue, and I think is a little bit different from some of the views that others take with regard to sex differences. So appreciate that brain development is a very intense and yet protracted process. So it begins prenatally. This just shows brain development before birth. But the key thing about development, like any other part of the body, is that it's an interaction between nature and nurture. By nature, we're referring to genes and hormones. The nurture side is the environment, the practice component. And the key thing is that these start interacting from the first moment of development, even at this little neural tube stage here, just 4 weeks, when you've got this little dot of a brain compared to 9 months. These two influences are interacting, what the mother has eaten and the chemical factors that she's exposed to in utero. And so we refer to this effect of the environment on the brain as plasticity. And plastic is kind of an ugly thing. We don't like plastic toys and we don't like plastic furniture. But the truth is, when we're talking about the brain, plasticity is a beautiful, beautiful thing. It really is the basis of any learning. It's the basis of recovery from any brain injury. So a lot of people in neuroscience are very, very interested in plasticity. And we know there's a couple of very simple rules for how this plasticity works. We say that the brain is able to change because it's activity dependent. The actual electrical activity in neural circuits fixes their physical connectivity. So we have one rule that is cells that fire together wire together. So I've drawn two neurons here. I don't know if you can see them, it's a little washed out. A red neuron, and a neuron has this tree structure with branches on top, the dendrites that take in information, and this axon on the bottom that sends out information and forms a synapse onto the next neuron in the chain, and so on and so on, and we get this massive circuit. So cells that fire together, the wire together, if a neuron's electrically active, it actually will increase the number of connections. It will physically grow more synapses. And if the activity persists, those will be permanent. On the other hand, there's a simple use it or lose it rule, which is the flip side, which is that synapses that are not activated, experiences that don't happen, those synapses get pruned back. And so together, we have these two rules that are working every millisecond in your child's brain in every circuit that are wiring up where they go. And all of this continues throughout life. I mean, congratulations to you all. You're here on a Friday evening trying to learn something new because your synapses are, by all means, still capable of changing. And the more you work those synapses, the more resistant you will be to Alzheimer's disease. And there's good news for keeping your brain active. But the fact of the matter is, on a quantitative scale, this kind of plasticity is far more potent in very early childhood than later in life. And the earlier in childhood you go, the more plastic. So in the womb, things are most malleable, and then the first couple of years, and then sort of on a sliding scale after that. Well, I showed you a couple stick figures. Here's what these real neurons look like. They're quite beautiful. I'm from Chicago, where the trees are bare all winter. We don't have a lot of evergreens. And so you look out in the sky and you see these bare branches, which look exactly like neurons, I swear. The branching patterns, it's just like looking through a microscope. And I hope they're beautiful to you. Each one of these neurons has massive dendritic branches here and dendritic branches with axons coming off. And so appreciate that there are about 100 billion brain cells in all of our brains, beginning, and this forms as early as 6 months in utero, so we form these 100 billion neurons, and each neuron is getting about 10,000 connections onto it. So 10,000 times 100 billion, we're looking at 1 quadrillion synapses that need to sort themselves out in a young child's brain. It's a pretty overwhelming problem, and so the good news for any of you young students interested in neuroscience, you will have a career for a very long time to come. There's a lot to work out. So brain development is very intense early in life. All these neurons are present early on, but you see these dendritic branches have yet to really grow much. And so it's very much like the growth of a forest. A little baby neuron is like a sapling, and you have billions of these, and as they put their branches out, basically you have this massive canopy that's thickening, and the whole brain gets bigger and much more connected, and circuits literally turn on. Marion Diamond at Berkeley, a number of years ago, wrote a book called Magic Trees of the Mind, where she talked about her research on environmental enrichment and how it affects the structures of neurons because they're so tree-like, and I just love that metaphor. As these synapses turn on, babies' abilities turn on. So infants can do a few things at birth, but not a whole lot with the cerebral cortex. A lot of a newborn's behavior is more at the brainstem level, you know, sucking and swallowing and reflexive survival sorts of things. But very quickly after birth, the number of synapses just takes off, and you can see what that does for a baby's vision. The sense of vision improves dramatically. Babies aren't blind at birth, but they see things pretty blurry. They don't see full color perception. They don't see depth perception. All of that sort of kicks in between birth and 6 months of age, thanks to the increase in the number of synapses. But there's also kind of a downside to what goes on after this initial bout of synapse production, and that is the basis of these critical periods I was talking about. So this is the classic data that comes from the visual system, the back of your brain, the occipital lobe back here. Believe it or not, even the sense of vision is highly, highly plastic. I mean, you would think, of all things, why can't vision be hardwired? You just open up a baby's eyes and they see the world for what it is, you know, like a couple of cameras, but it doesn't work that way. Even the sense of vision depends on early experience. And so in normal situations, a baby with two healthy eyes will get the normal input to the brain, and the visual circuitry will sort it out for detecting form and color and depth and all these things. But if a child has a visual problem, and the most common problem is strabismus or crossed eyes, and what happens is a child will tend to squint if they have one eye that's weak. They will tend to squint that weak eye because it's very disconcerting to have double vision. And so what ends up happening is a child cuts off the visual input from the weak eye and the strong eye takes over. And as I was using the analogy earlier, and I think Alaskans can appreciate this, basically what's going on in the visual cortex, and in fact the whole cerebral cortex from the moment of birth, is a big, fast land grab. Everybody wants input to the cerebral cortex. And so in the case of the visual system, you've got two eyes, and they both want input to the cortex. But it's the actual experience of seeing that determines who wins. So if one eye is stronger than the other, and that's the situation down here, you see these stripes are uneven. So in the normal situation, black and white stripes, left and right eye, have equal access to the cortex. But in the child that is deprived of vision in one eye, the white stripes take over. The good eye takes over, and the bad eye loses input. And unfortunately, if we don't correct this problem early, and the good news for visual problems is we can correct these. There's lots of methods with patching and surgery to catch this in the first few years and to rescue babies with visual problems. But it illustrates how sensitive the brain is to early experience. And it's different from an adult brain, because if a person grows up with normal vision and then all of a sudden has a visual problem, let's say you develop a cataract in your 60s or 70s, you can have this cataract for years, which degrades the quality of visual input, alters the activity going to the eye. But if you remove that bad lens, a cataract is just a cloudy lens, if you remove the cloudy lens and just wear a pair of glasses or contact lenses, your vision will restore exactly where it was before, because you already wired up properly. Once the circuit's in place, it's good to go. But if you don't do it right the first time around during this critical period, you result in a permanent visual deficit. So if a child doesn't get corrected, they have permanently what we call amblyopia, or very degraded vision in this weak eye. So it's a harsh reality, but this is how the brain works. Early experience is crucial. And we know it's the case for the visual system. We know it's the case for most of the brain. And clearly this has been shown in the case of language. There's a critical period for language. The language you're immersed in, we all know, we grow up speaking something effortlessly. Nobody had to teach you English or Spanish or I've forgotten the name of the native Alaskan language I learned this morning. I'm sorry. Yupik, thank you. Whatever you're immersed in from early on, you will learn quite easily. But of course, we all know the experience, or many of us know the experience of trying to learn a language later in life becomes much, much more difficult. Because once the synapses are dedicated to your native language, they have a much more difficult time in later life dedicating themselves to another language. And this is just illustrates the left hemisphere of the brain, the part of the brain that's so important for language. So we have critical periods for vision. We have critical periods for language. Some of this is kind of scary. As a parent, you're thinking, everything's so intense, but we can't, rest assured, you can't stimulate every circuit. You wouldn't be healthy to stimulate every darn circuit of a baby, but a good, loving, nurturing, and interactive environment will take care of things. You do want to make sure the baby's vision is good and hearing is good, and that they're getting a lot of language stimulation. So I'll come back to this when we talk about boys whose verbal, the verbal gap isn't so big, but some of the reading and writing issues are related to this early language input. But everything we know about language tells us that this early language input is just crucial for a quality of a child's abilities. So moving on to the gender issue then, if you appreciate just how remarkably plastic the brain is, then I think it's pretty hard to think about gender learning without appreciating that boys and girls essentially grow up with two different cultures. If you think of the way we talk differently to boys and girls, we dress them differently, we label them differently, we have very different role models for them, and of course the toys are different. So the problem is that there's nothing the matter with traditional girl play or traditional boy play. And I have to say, I took this picture off a cover of a book that's several years old by an educational consultant telling preschool teachers how to gear their teaching towards boys and girls. And it was just so stereotypical. It was really remarkable. But I would argue, in fact, what we really want to do is sort of cross-train boys and girls. So given that boy play is really good for spatial skills and physical skills, and girl typical play is very good for language skills and relational skills, what we really want to do is not pull the trucks out of the boys' hands and give them to the girls, but just encourage that all children get to exercise all of their circuits early on. So before I leave the topic of plasticity, I want to try to convince you, and it was really rather surprising to me too, that this plasticity even extends to one's gender identity. This very deep-seated sense, I am a male or I am a female, which it seems as sort of instinctive as, the language that you speak. And in fact, what was surprising to me in my research was that even gender identity is malleable. And it's not the kind of experiment I'm advocating anybody do, but it is actually possible to take an XY chromosome child, a boy, and raise him as a girl. And it's, again, not something we do lightly, but physicians, pediatricians have actually counseled this for years for a few select medical disorders, where there basically are birth defects that are very profound in the urogenital system, and surgeons need to construct a urogenital system. And, you know, what's easier, girl or boy, if you had to build one? Traditionally, they have found it easier to create a female body. And so there are these rare genetic boys that have been raised as girls. And one study, there aren't a lot, is the good news. And I think surgery is getting better, so that it's not necessarily the treatment in every case. But there was a large enough cohort that Meyer Ballberg, who's at Columbia University, published a review in 2005 that tracked 77 cases of genetic boys raised as girls. And remarkably enough, the vast majority of them, 60 of the 77, were content with their female identity. So these were young women who were women in spite of their XY chromosomes. And he concluded that the data do not support a full biological theory of determinism, and one must conclude that gender assignment and concomitant social factors have a major influence on gender outcome. Wow. You know, that was really, I think, kind of a surprise to people. And then here's another review of individuals with disorders, XY individuals with disorders of sexual development, revealed gender identity is predominantly influenced by learning and socialization associated with the sex of rearing. So, remarkably enough, and it's not something I recommend, that we switch gender identity in children, but just keep your mind open to this idea that that the way we treat children actually influences a lot of their sense of gender perception. So with that as a background and the plasticity of the brain, I want to show you what current science has told us about sex differences in the brain. And I really emphasize in all these data I'm going to show you, these are large studies, because the kind of thing that Luann Brizendine publishes in her Male Brain and Female Brain, she'll often find a single study with, you know, 19 males and 18 females and make this dramatic claim about the differences between males and females. Leonard Sachs's books have done the same for children, and they simply do not reflect the aggregate of the data, the meta-analysis. So in order to understand sex differences, you really got to do a little bit of statistics here, a little bit of understanding of quantitative differences, and that's what we call effect size. So kind of the classic sex difference between males and females is height. The average male is 5'10", the average female is 5'4", that's about a 6-inch difference, and we calculate a number called a D value, an effect size, that basically is the difference of the means divided by the standard deviation, which is the spread of the curve. And so the difference in height is what we would call a very large sex difference. Any kind of D value above 1.0 is considered very large. So the sex difference is pretty darn reliable. If somebody's 6 feet tall, it's a pretty good chance it is a male, although it could be a female. There's a few females over here. But by and large, males and females do separate pretty well on height. Now, compare this physical difference to a psychological difference. For example, the sex difference in empathy, or the ability to read emotional expression on another person's face. And this is an objective measure. You don't want to look at subjective measures of empathy. If I ask you, how do you feel if your friend is sick, or you know, how important is it you to take care of your mother? Women and men report very different degrees of empathy, but objective empathy measures. How quick can you recognize fear or anger or sadness in another person's facial expression? The difference is, as you see, quite a bit smaller. Yes, females on average outperform males, but the difference is a mere third of a standard deviation. And so when people look at all the different sex differences we're aware of, you know, math and spatial skills, cognitive skills, verbal, reading, writing, emotional expression, you name it, the vast majority of sex differences turn out to be smaller than this. And so Janet Hyde is at University of Wisconsin-Madison, wrote this big paper in 2005, the Gender Similarities Hypothesis, which was basically a meta-analysis of meta-analyses. She took every study that had already combined dozens of studies, and it turned out that 3/4 of sex differences are smaller than this effect size. So There are statistically significant differences, but they are quantitatively rather small. So instead of this notion of Mars and Venus, a better way to describe sex differences might be that women are from North Dakota, men are from South Dakota. With great apologies to any of you from the Dakotas. So please keep these curves in mind, okay? This degree of overlap in behavior, because I think you'll find it's not a whole lot different from what we find in the brain.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Associate Professor of Neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School, Dr. Lise Elliott. Her talk, based on her latest book, Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It, was recorded at the Wilda Marston Theater on February 1st.
The one thing we know for sure about sex differences, the biggest sex difference, and this actually has a D value about 1.0, I'm not drawing it that way, is that the male brain is larger than the female brain. From birth all the way through the lifespan, males have about a 10, maybe up to 14% larger brain. Males' bodies are bigger than females' bodies. We looked at the height difference, weight difference. And what you rarely hear, but is equally true, is that men's hearts, even boys' hearts and kidneys and lungs and spleens, all the organs are kind of scaled up in the male body. So I don't think we can take a lot away from the sex difference in brain size. Now, a more textured difference is that girls' brains finish growing earlier than boys' brains. The brain actually does this very important thing that is important for learning, where we produce lots of synapses and then we prune them back. And this is actually a big part of this critical period phenomenon. And it turns out that, all adolescents are going through this pruning period, which is when circuits are being refined and really dedicated to what they're spending their time on. And you see that girls undergo this inflection earlier than boys, by about 1 to 2 years. But you know what? This actually coincides with the onset of puberty, which is also 1 to 2 years earlier in girls than boys. So I think that these curves of brain growth are really just a good reflection of overall physical growth. So these are the most reliable and biggest differences between male and female brains. When we get to other differences, it turns out there's a lot more myth than reality. So here's a common notion you may have heard. Men tend to use one hemisphere at a time, but women employ whole brain thinking, or women are better connected. Does that ring any bells? Have you heard that? Yeah. And in fact, I pulled this right off of, I mean, I've read it many places, but this is off of a website, girlslearndifferently.com, you know, and it was talking about how great girls' brains are because they're so well connected. This turns out to be a big old myth. But the real data show that both men and women are left hemisphere dominant. Yes, there's a statistically significant difference between us, with men being a little bit more lateralized than females, but basically we're all left hemisphere dominant. And as I already told you, the left hemisphere is the language side of the brain. We think more with the language side of our brain, because most of us think in words after about the age of 3. And other studies as well find that sex or gender accounts for a relatively small proportion, maybe up to 2% of the variance in brain laterality can be accounted for by gender. So there are these small differences, but they just are not categorical. So I just want you to appreciate when you pick up your Time Magazine or Google News, or next time you see some brain scans of men and women lighting up differently, I just want you to think about, even if you do see a sex difference, what is the cause of that difference? Just because there's a difference doesn't necessarily mean it's, just because the brain is biological doesn't mean a sex difference is hardwired, although that's often our first impulse. So I just have a little bit of a thought experiment here. These are two subjects, let's call them X and Y. They're lying in the brain scanner and they are responding to a moral dilemma. They're given a scenario and asked if this decision was morally correct or immoral. And you see subject X and subject Y have pretty different responses. X has a big activation of the medial prefrontal cortex. Subject Y, this little blip on the orbital frontal pole, and I'm deliberately misleading you because subject X is not a female, subject Y is not a male. These are two subjects who were raised in the same culture, except one was raised as a Christian and one was raised as a non-believer. And yet their brains respond very differently to this moral dilemma. And so I would argue that gender learning is at least as potent as these other forms of cultural experience in shaping the way our brains function. So when you see a brain scan of somebody who's 20 or 30 or 40 years old, how the heck do you know that those differences are a result of genes or hormones versus a lifetime of experience, which we know wires up the brain? And so as I leave the topic of the brain specifically, appreciate that I'm not the only one who's found some flaws in these claims of brain sex difference. A couple of other books came out a little bit after mine that have made many of the same critiques. And Cordelia Fines is particularly witty. She's a cognitive neuroscientist from Australia. All right, so with that said, we have these small differences in behavior, we have small differences in the brain. How do they get there? And there certainly is a role, as I already told you, for hormonal influence, but it's kind of interesting. It's not what you might have read if you are a follower of Michael Gurian. You guys, anybody read Gurian? He's from Spokane, so not all that far away. his reach is pretty broad. He's been at this for a while. He's not actually a scientist or clinician or physician, but he likes the brain, and he read some article in Reader's Digest one time, and he's turned it into a few books. So he's written this book, Boys and Girls Learn Differently! ! And it has sold so well to so many teachers, and so many taxpayer dollars have been used to send teachers to his summer institute, that he was able to publish a new edition of it, 10th anniversary edition. So this idea is still out there. And let me give you an example of something Gurian states about hormones. Girls have great difficulty learning math because of testosterone. Surges of the hormone, which males receive during adolescence between 5 and 7 times a day, can increase spatial skills. The adolescent girl may have a few days a month when she performs very well on any sort of test, including math, but the male may have certain times every day when he might perform better at spatials, such as higher math. So this is, unfortunately, I kid you not, what many teachers believe, and this is one of the rationales for separating boys and girls and treating them differently. And if you want to learn more, you can go to his summer institute, where, as I mentioned, he's training thousands of teachers. But it's pretty distressing, and it's so far removed from the real data. So let me just give you a synopsis of what, and this is really spelled out in my book. I read many, many, many studies to try to get to this answer, which is that hormones have modest effects before birth, but actually these effects later in life are almost negligible or non-existent. So basically there's two surges of hormones in life. There's the prenatal surge. Boys get exposed to testosterone before birth when the testes form. Girls, estrogen, although estrogen can't cross the blood-brain barrier, and the placenta produces estrogen, so boys and girls are both exposed to estrogen, but it can't get into the brain because it's bound up to a protein. So testosterone's the only player here. Boys get testosterone, and it clearly masculinizes their bodies. It's what helps the plumbing come out the right way. And it also affects certain features of behavior. And a lot of this is really based on animal studies, rats and monkeys and so on. We know, for example, rough and tumble play is influenced by prenatal testosterone. Girls and female animals will do some of this wrestling, but not as much as males unless they're exposed to higher levels of prenatal testosterone. So these are the things that during this early phase, what we call the organizational or prenatal phase, that testosterone influences. It does influence toy preference in young children, the trucks versus dolls dilemma. It likely influences later sexual preference or orientation. I believe it probably affects activity level, and I left it off here. I think that may also affect some of these spatial skills. So Gurion had an inkling of it, but he was at the wrong phase, and it certainly wasn't not these enormous fluctuations. All these things, again, are just small biases, and then what happens after birth is what those biases turn into. So after birth, we have a little surge of hormones that is biologically irrelevant based on a lot of animal studies. It ends by 3 months of age. And then we go through this wonderful period called the juvenile pause, when there's very low levels of gonadal hormones and our kids are kind of free and free-spirited and uncomplicated, and there's actually no difference in hormone titers between boys and girls until the onset of puberty, when of course girls enter puberty earlier than boys and begin to cycle in their estrogen and progesterone. Boys start producing testosterone in much higher levels. Of course, females also have testosterone. Males also have estrogen and progesterone. It's just a question of degree. But a lot of studies have looked at this later phase, the adult surges in hormones, and have had surprisingly modest effects. In spite of what we may think about PMS, in spite of what we think about moodiness, in spite of what women on postmenopausal hormones may have believed, it turns out that these hormones have very little effect. So there's been studies of women after menopause. Probably some of the most interesting studies are of transsexuals. When somebody's actually changing genders, they have to undergo very powerful hormone treatment. You cut out the old gonad, you get the new hormone, whether it's testosterone to estrogen or vice versa. And interestingly, the studies of these individuals psychologically, while the person may psychologically feel different and better to be the sex that they want to be, if you actually test their spatial skills, their verbal skills, their math skills, even a lot of features of mood are not affected in spite of these dramatic hormone exposures. Another study of delayed puberty, adolescents who were whose puberty is not on time will sometimes be treated with hormones to speed it up. And so there was this beautiful placebo-controlled study out of the University of Pennsylvania, and there was no effect on boys given testosterone or girls given estrogen, again, on all of these measures of mood and cognition. So negligible effects of adult hormones on our brain function, some effect of testosterone early in life on some of these other behaviors. So with that as the backdrop, then let's see the many ways in which this background is influenced. We know that gender is socially learned. I showed you the evidence from gender identity. And also there's some great studies where babies are disguised. You can take a baby boy and give him a girl's name and vice versa, and then ask an adult to interact with them. Or you can just dress babies in gender-neutral clothes and call them John or Jill, and you will see that people respond differently, talk differently, interact differently, depending on whether they believe a child is a boy or a girl. And so the role of culture and gender learning includes family, peers, teachers, and this larger culture. And really, isn't this what we're talking about, right? I mean, this is what's valued for the most part at a superficial level, but also at deep in our hearts. Everybody knows it's important for males to be strong and females to be beautiful. And that is something that shapes children's development. And so all of these influences, family, peers, et cetera, have been shown to play some role. Although I already told you testosterone has a role in many of these. On top of the testosterone is also the social learning effect that's been demonstrated for each of these. So we all know, the differences. A boy is born, he's either smart or strong. A girl basically is beautiful. When you send the cards, we go to the toy stores, good old Toys R Us. There's the pink aisle and the blue aisle, and never the twain shall meet. With boys' toys being more sports and building oriented, and war, of course, and girls being about beauty or babies. The irony is, Legos are now considered a boy toy. There was some study like 80-90% of Lego sets are bought for boys, even though what a great toy this is for building those spatial skills I keep referring to. The irony is when Legos were first created in the 80s late 70s, it was considered gender neutral. That was a big selling point in Sweden, where they come from, that, you know, what it is beautiful. Here's this little girl, you know, with this multicolored thing, and nobody's thinking of Lego as a gender toy, but now, of course, they are. Legos became a boy toy, so what did Legos do last year? They came up with Lego Friends, girly Legos. And all of the sets are sort of stereotypical girl interests. And worst of all, the dolls, they don't even show them here, the characters, instead of the little blocky Lego guys, they're tall and thin, of course, because we gotta start that, developing that anorexia as early as possible. Well, how will the girls figure it out? Okay. Look at this, even crayons. Now, I swear, I think things have gotten, is it just me, or do things seem more gender divided? I think part of it is the prenatal testing. In the old days, you know, at least a baby had the luxury of the first 9 months of not being gender labeled. Now, you know, it's over at 20 weeks. They know the boy or the girl, and all the clothes are determined beforehand. So, yeah, in some ways, I think things have gotten more gender divided. And I think some of this is fueled by this bad science that claims all these hardwired differences. That, you know, it's fun to have a boy and a girl, and, you know, if you're a heterosexual couple, it's fun to have them be different, but I think it's not necessarily in anybody's best interest, and here's why. So this was a study done at NYU. Mothers brought their babies into the lab. These were infants at the crawling stage. None of them could walk yet, and believe it or not, they asked the moms to crank up this ramp. What is the steepest ramp you think your baby will crawl down? But it turned out when you tested the moms before, and of course they didn't test dads, they only asked moms, beforehand, the moms underestimated for their daughters. So they made it shallower for their daughters than the moms of boys did. And but in fact, when they were tested, there was no difference at age 11 months in their ability. Boys and girls both crawled down really steep slopes. And as I showed earlier today, there's actually no difference in gross motor skills. Walking, sitting, standing, all of those are the same age of onset in boys and girls. So we know that parents are biased, and we try hard, but we're all, you know, we just have to accept the fact that we are biased and try to be aware of it. Unfortunately, I think teachers are also have the same gender biases that we all have. We know the effect of teacher bias. There's something called the Pygmalion effect, this famous study from the 70s, where kids were randomly divided in a classroom, but the teachers were told, you know, this half is your smart kids, and this half are your slow kids, and guess what? By the end of the year, they lived up to expectations because the teachers acted accordingly. But here's a couple of quotes from teachers that illustrate this kind of bias. Recent quotes, boys learn differently. They need hands-on activities and motor breaks. Well, I don't know, Piaget, Montessori, I think would agree that every child needs hands-on activity and motor breaks. Girls generally work well with others, and talking about a concept with a peer can help them understand it. Social skills seem to come naturally to them. Okay, well, I think that all children are equally social at birth. If it's one thing that our infants are programmed for, it is social awareness. We are a very social species, and babies, boys and girls, prefer the human face, the human voice, the human smell to any other stimulus. So to think that only girls are socially oriented and boys aren't is really, I think, doing a disservice to boys. There's definitely a difference in language, but it's, again, much smaller than we perceive. Girls are only about 1 month ahead of boys in the size of their vocabulary. So if a pediatrician tells a family, you know, oh, don't worry if, you know, your son's not talking yet, he's a boy. Well, exactly wrong. We need to be very aware of any language delay and be, you know, very proactive about enriching children's exposure to books and songs and stories and speech therapy if necessary. So it turns out that gender is just a very small factor in terms of overall language development, just 0.2 of a standard deviation difference, and that's in large studies around the world. So girls are not that much more verbal than boys, but they do talk earlier, and then guess what? Mothers actually talk more to their daughters than their sons in this 3-4 years of age. So this is this idea of these small differences, how we contribute to magnifying them, and maybe a little more self-awareness. We could invoke more conversation from our boys, read more to our boys, and try to keep that gap from growing larger. Because in current situation, there is a pretty substantial reading gap. The math gap is actually gone. There's no difference between boys and girls, but as the reading data show, across 40 years, we see this same gap, and you see that girls are outperforming boys in reading at every age for the last 40 years. So what do we need to do? We need best beginnings. We need to get lots of books in the hands of boys and much more reading to them. So if you haven't seen this YouTube video, this notion that boys don't talk, these are two little twin boys, and it is just the cutest little conversation.
If you'd like to watch the video of the talking twin babies, go to alaskapublic.org.
So, good. Let me just give you a couple of take-home messages then. Hopefully, I've made the point that, yes, there are differences, but what we do and how we treat boys and girls can either magnify or minimize. And I would argue in today's society, minimizing is probably the better way to go, given that we're trying to run families and societies together. And I have to say, somebody came up to me after an earlier talk and said, you know, it's different up here. Women know how to change tires and shoot moose and fish and, you know, so that's great. And I'm glad to hear it. And I do think there is a lot of cultural variation. You know, you go to a place like Saudi Arabia and the sex roles are quite a bit different than they would be here. So, okay, so here are some lessons that we've learned or I think we need to take account for girls, but you know what? Every one of these things is also good and important for boys. Teach spatial skills. I didn't take a lot of time to go into this. I have a whole chapter in my book on it, but this is a whole part of the curriculum we don't even deliberately teach, and the more we've worried about the three R's, the less we've focused on some of these three-dimensional spatial skills. And particularly in this day of GPS, the ability to read a map and orient yourself from a two-dimensional image to the three-dimensional world, which, by the way, is what you do with Legos, is something that needs to get a lot more practice. And this is important for engineering, and it's important for calculus and geometry and organic chemistry and just all kinds of architecture, all kinds of fields. We need more experience, and I think it should be a whole. There are many people in mathematics who think this really should be added to the curriculum from a very early age. Oh, and this just demonstrates that the kind of spatial skills we're talking about, things like mental rotation, all of these do get better with practice. And there's actually professor at Michigan Tech who's developed a curriculum for first-year engineering students. It's particularly geared towards the women engineers to keep them in the program by giving them this booster of spatial skills. But we really and it works quite well, but we really should be starting much earlier. Physical challenges in sports. You know, a lot of girls are getting the opportunity to play sports now, but not all, and they're facing these conflicting challenges. You know, even out on the playground, it turns out we encourage our sons to climb high more than our daughters. And we need to promote leadership for girls, and often that's done in a single-sex setting, but I would argue we need to do that more in mixed-sex settings, and I think that men and women both need to be comfortable. Boys and girls need to be comfortable leading each other. Risk-taking, I think that's where we often find some of the differences. Why we hit the glass ceiling is that women aren't putting themselves out there. This is where the sports have proven beneficial. Girls are getting more comfortable with competition, but we still have a gap there. And we need to reward critical thinking over compliance. So girls often, the classic, it's not difference between boys and girls in schools, that girls get better grades and boys do better on standardized testing. It's the grade test disparity. And one of the reasons girls get better grades is because they do what they're told and they are more concerned with pleasing the teacher. But maybe some of that pleasing the teacher is coming at the expense of being more challenging or critical thinking. So we need to reward some of that more critical thinking. We need to teach young women that to negotiate for their salaries. There's turns out that even in this day and age, women and men graduating with exactly the same credentials going on to exactly the same jobs, women are being paid about 5% less just because they're not negotiating. Now, the overall gender gap is still about 20%, but in this situation, we need to teach this negotiation skill. And also to all of our students, this equation that if you stay with math, your chances of landing a job, that most of the jobs that depend on math actually pay better than jobs that don't, including all the STEM. And I would argue that not just girls, all of our children need to learn some computer programming skills. I just got back from the Blake School in Minneapolis, very nice private kindergarten or pre-K to grade 12 school, where they are actually doing this beginning at the pre-K level. There are easy programming packages that young children can get a start on this. Okay, and then for boys, but equally valuable for girls, more physical breaks and outdoor play. Kids these days, none of them are getting enough activity, enough recess, enough breaks in their long, intense school days, and all would benefit from more recesses. Books, books, books. there's no question this is the very best way to close the literacy gap and improve verbal skills. And also, we need to engage our boys in one-on-one dialogue, just like those twins, because that is really the best way to promote vocabulary. So for a good source for books for boys, there's a great website called guysread.com by John Shishka? Chicheska. Thank you. Some really good suggestions for boys and boys reading clubs. Thanks so much for your attention.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Associate Professor of Neuroscience at Chicago Medical School, Dr. Lise Elliott. Her talk, based on her latest book, Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It, was recorded at the Wilda Marston Theater on February 1st and shortened for broadcast on KSKA. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. Special thanks to our UAA intern, Evan Erickson, who assisted with recording and editing this week's program. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.